Then, still looking at his face, I saw there something that sent a quiver through my whole body. I stood at that moment with my back to the east and the mountains, and he, facing me, looked toward them. His face flushed with a new light. A fern 30 yards behind him turned golden. The eastern side of every tree trunk grew bright. Shadows deepened. All the time, there had been bird noises, trillings, chatterings, and the like. But now, suddenly, the full chorus poured forth from every branch. Cocks were crowing. There was music of hounds and horns. Above all this, 10,000 tongues of men and woodland angels, and the wood itself sang. It comes, they sang. Sleepers, awake, it comes, it comes, it comes. One dreadful glance over my shoulder, I essayed, not long enough to see, or did I see, the rim of the sunrise that shoots time dead with golden arrows and puts flight to all phantasmal shapes. Well, hello everyone, and welcome to the final episode of Reading with Joy, our summer book club looking at The Great Divorce by C.S. Lewis. This has been quite a summer, quite a journey. I've so loved reading this with you all, seeing your comments and thoughts, and even though I did my master's dissertation on it, I feel like I've learned so much more about it, even just doing it with you guys. I am so excited and sad to give you this last episode, where I'll look at the very last chapter and then finally provide some suggestions about what I think we're meant to take away from this book. Now, at the suggestion of Emma, who said several very wonderful suggestions, I will be attaching in the show notes a book list of all the books you might want to read if you wanted to go further into the ideas or kind of see the background of The Great Divorce. So that will include some important ones, like some of Lewis's other work, like Surprised by Joy, but it will also look at things like Augustine and Blake. And so if you are interested in looking more at that, that will be my parting gift to you all as a reading list for The Great Divorce. I can't tell you how wonderful it has been to do this, and I can't believe we made it all the way to the end. Now, before I get started, I want to let you all know that 2 weeks from today, I'm going to be posting this on the 6th, or not on the 6th, I'm sorry, I'll be posting on the 30th of July. 2 weeks from today, which will be the 13th of August, I will be announcing all of the podcasts for this fall. I've been very busy making up a show list and looking at topics I thought really interesting and getting some of your feedback. So I'll be announcing all of the shows for this autumn and also be launching something very exciting, which I'm not going to tell you what it is now. So you'll just have to keep your eyes out and look on the Facebook page at Joy Clarkson, the public page, not my personal page. And then also keep checking on Twitter and looking on the website. So I wanted to let you all know that I'm sad to be ending this book club, but I'm also really excited for everything that's going to be coming in the fall. So without further ado, let us dive into this week's final chapter of The Great Divorce. Now, as I read in the opening, this has this shocking moment that we've kind of been waiting for the whole book. The whole book, we've had this sense of when you're in hell, it's right before the sun is about to set. And when you're in heaven, it's right before the sun is supposed to rise. And finally, in this final moment, you see that the sun begins to rise. And he becomes fearful because he realizes this is the image of the final judgment, that there's no longer any kind of waiting. And he says in this that he starts to feel things fall upon his head. And he says, the morning, I am caught by the morning, and I am a ghost. And then he wakes up and he finds out that it was all a dream. And, also we have this little image at the very beginning of the chapter where he talks about seeing everyone as chess pieces that are moving along the board, and that everything he's been seeing has been kind of this demonstration of the choice, that there are all these chess pieces moving around, and I'll unpack what that means. Now, it's really funny to note that Tolkien hated it that he ended it like this. He hated that it was a dream. He said, it's no fair to have your readers be so engaged with the story, and then to tell them that it was all false, that it wasn't anything, and that it was, you know, just a dream. And this goes along with Tolkien's idea of, he says that when you do anything that's like a fantasy, you should have your readers entirely believe in it. They have to believe in it like it's the rules of the ordinary world. And so it's kind of breaking trust with your audience to then make it a dream. But of course, the reason that Lewis does this is because it's an imaginative proposal. His point is to give us kind of an image, a vision even, if you wanted to think about that, a vision of the impact of choices that we make on Earth, but not to make it a theological kind of final decision. So that's kind of what we see with this dream element. And so I wanted to focus for a moment on the idea of the chessmen. He talks about how I knew the chessmen were the idiom or the puppet representative of someone of the great presences that stood by, and the acts and motions of each chessman were a moving portrait, a mimicry or pantomime which delineated the inmost nature of his giant master. So there's this sense, and the silver table is time, and those who stand and watch are the immortal souls of the same men and women. So you get this kind of interesting image of all of these scenes that we've been seeing as though they are this great chess game, and you're waiting to see who wins. Now, in that sense, I remember when I first read this, I thought, this all sounds rather deterministic. It sounds kind of like the people who are going to be saved are going to be saved, and people who weren't, aren't. But I was talking to a friend who did her dissertation on something else on Lewis, and she told me that that Lewis uses this chessman analogy somewhere else. And it's interesting because the place that he uses it, this idea of the choice and the struggle for salvation being a chess game, is in his own spiritual autobiography, Surprised by Joy. And in the chapter that recounts his actual conversion, which is, I'm trying to see, it's chapter 14 in Surprised by Joy, he calls it checkmate. And when he writes about it as being this game between him and God. And he doesn't want to surrender because, you know, ultimately, when you win in chess, you don't just kill all the pieces. It's the surrender of one king to another king. And so he describes his own conversion process as a chess game. And so I think it's interesting to kind of have that mindset, understanding this is what's happening in this depiction, because it's less of a deterministic viewpoint of those who said this were going to win and those who didn't are going to lose. You know, those are, some people are automatically damned, some people are automatically saved. It's less of that and more of almost, it almost is, go back to that universalism, that sense of God is a better chess player than we are. And all that we're seeing here is the chess game between our will and God's. And I think having that little background gives us a better image. So moving on to that, seeing this image of the sunrise. As I said, he talks a lot about how time, MacDonald says it in this, where he says, you saw the choices a bit more clearly than you could see them on earth. The lens was clear, but it was still through the same lens. Do not ask of a vision in a dream more than a vision or a dream can give. So there's a sense that what we've seen in these visions is that time has been frozen, and we're seeing choices that were made over and over and over again on earth. And that when the sunrise finally comes, they kind of get frozen wherever they were. And so there's that kind of sense of urgency that they have to make the right decisions before the sun finally rises. And that's why he wakes up in this panic, saying, the morning, I'm caught by the morning and I'm a ghost. And I think that he does this to leave us with this urgency to think of our choices as being those choices that are depicted in the visions in heaven. That our little temporal choices are the choices that we'll wrestle with. The sins, the desires, the ways that we turn inward towards ourselves. We are in the moment right now in between dawn, the sunrise and dawn. And so he kind of does that to instill in us this urgency. An urgency to remember that our choices matter and that the way we live our lives is, according to Lewis, having some kind of eternal destiny. And we'll go into that a little bit. But he also always cases it, reminding us that it's not a theological treatise. He says, I'll have no Swedenborgs, no Vale Owens among my children. And Swedenborg actually inspired William Blake. He was this kind of crazy theologian. And Vale Owens was the spiritualist who Sir Arthur Conan Doyle actually really liked, who said that he could see heaven and he knew how everything was. So Lewis wants to distance himself from that. He doesn't want to say that this is a depiction of what heaven is like or that it's a theological thing that should be taken seriously. Rather, it's a work that's meant to make us take our choices seriously and to imagine that they might have eternal consequences and that they might have eternal consequences because our choices are making us a particular kind of thing and they're either leading us towards reality, towards love and towards God or away. So that's what I think the book ends with, is this urgency. An urgency to rethink your own life, your choices, to think, am I turning inwards towards self or outwards towards joy? And so I just wanted to end this whole series with kind of pointing out, what are some things we can take away? What is it that should be the things we remember from this book? And for me, there are three, and this has hit me in different levels over and over again whenever I've done this. The first is that desire is good. Over and over again, we have this kind of idea repeated to us that it's not desire that's ever wrong, but that we turn the desire inwards to our own kind of illusions of who we are, rather than opening it up to reality. And I wanted to make this point through reading something from The Weight of Glory, which really is such a consonant work by Lewis. When you read it, it's only a few pages, so you should definitely go read it. I'll attach it in the blog. But it's kind of an image of what we're seeing in this. And in it, he's talking about heaven, the desire for heaven. But he says this in one of the opening paragraphs. If there lurks in most modern minds the notion that to desire our own good and earnestly hope for the enjoyment of it is a bad thing, I submit that this notion has crept in from Kant and the Stoics, and is in no part of the Christian faith. Indeed, if we consider the unblushing promises of reward and the staggering nature of the rewards promised in the Gospels, it would seem that our Lord finds our desires not too strong, but too weak. We are half-hearted creatures, fooling about with drink and sex and ambition, when infinite joy is offered to us. Like an ignorant child who wants to go on making mud pies in a slum because he cannot imagine what is meant by the offer of a holiday by the sea, we are far too easily pleased. So this is one thing to take away from this. Your desires are good. And what we can see in all of these narratives is we see the mother desire, or the desire of lust that becomes this horse that draws them into heaven. The desire itself is never the problem. It's when we allow ourselves to desire too little. It's when we stop and we don't see through the desire to see that our ultimate satisfaction is in the God who made all of these good things to desire. So that's one thing to take away. I would say, do not hate your desires. Investigate them. See where God is in them and let him direct them to the right place. Let them become the horse that draws you into reality, that beautiful white horse that draws you into delight and joy when it's ordered and redeemed. So the first thing to remember this book is that desire is good. The second thing I think to remember that's really emphasized over and over again is that choices matter. And MacDonald says in one of the chapters when he's talking to the narrator, he says, "That thing is freedom, the gift whereby ye most resemble your maker and are yourselves a part of the eternal reality." Lewis thinks that choice is one of the main things that reflects our image of being in the image of God. It's something that is essential to human nature. It's so essential that God even allows us to choose to not be in relationship with him. But I think that what we come away with in this book is this picture that these little choices that we are making, whether it was the woman who was so used to choosing to grumble that she became a grumble, and you know that's all she is, or whether it was the murderer who's redeemed because he chooses to be repentant, we see that all of these little choices matter because, and I think this is the issue for Lewis, they matter because these choices are making something of you. And that's what we see in these ghosts, is that ultimately choice is a matter of what you are becoming. And Lewis offers us these two choices based in Augustine's. Either the choice of self, where we turn inward, where we choose our own kind of self-satisfaction, not based in reality, but how we feel about things, about how others make us feel about ourselves, where we turn inward, or the choice for joy, where we turn outwards towards God, where we love people for who they are, setting someone before us, and where we choose to turn towards God. And those are ultimately the two choices we have to make. And that as we make those choices, they are making something of us. So coming away from this book, take seriously that every choice you make, the choice to love, to forgive, the choice to move towards hope even when despair feels like the most sensible thing, the choice to love people, to set them before you as different, and to love them not for who they make you feel like you are, but for who they truly are. Those choices are making something of you eternally, and they matter profoundly. And he wants to make this so urgent to us, to say, don't be a ghost when the morning comes. Turn outward and let God redeem your will. Let it be something that your life is made up of choices that tell a good story. The choices make you more solid, more real, more loving, and as Lewis would say, more joyful. And I think the final thing this book teaches us, that Lewis wants us to come away with, is that everyone can be redeemed. And in this book, I think the people that we see being redeemed oftentimes are the most surprising. And Lewis does this to make us never lose hope that anyone can be redeemed. From the very beginning, we see one of the first people who is redeemed is a murderer. We see a murderer, a lustful person, a person who nobody else would kind of know in Sarah Smith, somebody who's anonymous. We see over and over again that all these people, the great, the small, the humble, the hateful, all of them, as MacDonald would say it, can have that spark of desire for God fanned into flame and be fully redeemed. And something that comes along with that is a sense of the significance of every person. I'm going to read you another quote from The Weight of Glory. It says, "It is a serious thing to live in a society of possible gods and goddesses, to remember that the dullest and most uninteresting person you talk to may one day be a creature which, if you saw it now, you would be strongly tempted to worship, or else a horror and a corruption, such as you are now meet, if at all, only in a nightmare. All day long, we are in some degree helping each other to one or other of these destinations. It is in the light of these overwhelming possibilities, it is with the awe and the circumspection proper to them, that we should conduct all our dealings with one another, all friendships, all loves, all play, all politics. There are no ordinary people. You have never talked to a mere mortal." And that's what we see in this book. We see no mere mortals. We see angels who are so great that we want to worship them, or ghosts who have diminished so far that it's like a nightmare. And I think that is a real admonition to us to think about people as no mere mortals, to know that everyone can be redeemed. There's no choice, no desire so wrongly formed that it cannot be turned and to become something glorious. And I wanted to end today with reading you from the final paragraph of that chapter called Checkmate in Surprised by Joy. Now, throughout this whole book, we've seen people who are constantly faced with the choice for joy or the choice for self. And as we see in this final chapter, that's depicted as this kind of chess game between the self and God, and that God is almost always a better chess player. And Lewis uses this to describe his own kind of choice for joy when it comes to choosing God in his own autobiography. And he talks about how he, in this whole chapter, he describes it as this intense game back and forth, and him trying everything he could do not to believe in God, because he came to faith when he was in his mid-30s, and he'd lived through World War I. He was, if one can be, a devout atheist, and he had experienced trauma and suffering, and becoming a Christian was not something that he wanted. But he describes his final surrender, because after all that I've said, this is kind of the final movement towards God, the surrender of saying, "Not my will, but yours be done," in these terms. And also, I think it's important to note that at the very opening of this chapter in Surprised by Joy, he quotes George MacDonald, who says, "The one principle of hell is I am my own." And I just think how interesting that he puts that at the opening of this chapter about his own final kind of giving in to God, when that is so much what we see in the Great Divorce, that ultimately people get to either be their own or to release themselves over to reality and to become new. So let me end with this final section from his own autobiography, his own depiction of himself going from ghost to spirit, as we can on earth. And I just want to say thank you to everyone who's listened. I hope that you've enjoyed this book series, and I look so forward to coming back in just a few weeks once we get started in the fall with our new podcast series. So let me end with Lewis's final losing of the chess game to his great joy. "You must picture me alone in that room in Magdalen, night after night, feeling, whenever my mind lifted even for a second from my work, the steady, unrelenting approach of him who I so urgently desired not to meet. That which I greatly feared had at last come upon me. In the Trinity term of 1929, I gave in. I admitted that God was God. I knelt and prayed. Perhaps that night, the most dejected and reluctant convert in all of England. I did not then see what is now the most shining and obvious thing, the divine humility which will accept a convert even on such terms. The prodigal son at least walked home on his own feet. But who can duly adore that love which will open the high gates to a prodigal who was brought in, kicking, struggling, resentful, and darting his eyes in every direction for a chance of escape. The words compel and trar, compel them to enter in, have been so abused by wicked men that we shudder at them. But properly understood, they plumb the depth of the divine mercy. The hardness of God is kinder than the softness of men, and his compulsion is our liberation.